Well, hello everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Adrienne Roeder. I am from Cornell University. And it's really a pleasure to be here as part of this program. I've been learning so much, and it's given me good time to think and reflect on things. And so I've put in a few philosophical slides, at least my philosophical slides, and we can maybe launch a discussion later on. So I want to tell you about robustness of organ size, and I'm going to do this in plants, but I think this is a question that's fundamental to any multicellular organism, is robustness and size. And just to start us off, here's a flower with robust size, and you can see like all the petals are the same size, and the sepals are the same size, and here's a flower that doesn't have robust size. You've got different sizes. Okay, so size is a critical characteristic of everything. And I know it's a question that's near and dear to your heart, as well as mine, is how is size regulated? And we can think about on the whole organism scale, so from giant sequoias down to Wolfia, one of the smallest flowering plants, or a mouse versus an elephant. Usually I'm not thinking on that scale, usually I'm thinking on the organ scale. And one of the classic examples is the liver, which actually scales to the size of the body. Or floral organs, which are scaled appropriately to attract pollinators. And this relates to cell size. And so the classic example of differences in cell size in animals is the egg versus the sperm cells are quite different size. And here's an example in plants where you've got different size hair cells and different shapes. So you've got three different kinds of hairs on this plant. And it's got the ones I've colored green, which are small. It's got the star-shaped ones and the purple ones that are so big they go out of frame. So clearly, size is very different and very important. And if we think about size and evolution, Peter Lawrence has said, size is the material evolution largely works on. But we're really very much in the dark about how this happens. So if you think about closely related species, one of the biggest differences tends to be their size. And here we have Arabidopsis thaliana versus Arabidopsis lyrata, so same genus, different species. And here's the two flowers, and what you can see is they've kind of got the same parts, each one has four petals, but the petals are very, very different sizes. So how does this happen? It has to have a genetic underpinning if evolution can work on it. It has to be quite malleable if evolution can work on it. And yet we don't understand it. So I'm choosing Arabidopsis thaliana as a model system to work on this question. And of course, you could work on it, and people have done very interesting work on it in all kinds of different species. And I'll throw in some links to Drosophila here and there. So here's Arabidopsis plants, here's the flower, and I'm going to choose the sepal, which is this outermost green floral organ. It's the one you ignore because you're looking at the petals, right? They're supposed to be the pretty ones. But sepals are awesome, and they're awesome because they're on the outside, and so I can get in there and access them. They're also awesome because they're relatively invariant to the environment. So plants are phenomenal in their environmental response, their developmental response. They do all kinds of changing of things. I don't need that extra complication in my life, so I'm picking an organ that's fairly unresponsive. And there's four sepals in a flower. That allows me to compare organ size within a single flower. So I can look for uniformity. And as I mentioned to begin with, they're really, really accessible. So let's look at this accessibility. What we like to do is live image the plants. Yeah. Okay, so good point. What it does is encloses and protects the bud while it's developing. So in the flower, you have the sepals, the petals, the stamens, and the carpels. The stamens are the male reproductive organs, the carpels are the female reproductive organs. In Arabidopsis, it's going to self-pollinate. And so while this is developing, and we're going to get to images of this, the sepals completely enclose that flower bud and keep it protected. So they're keeping everything, the environment, insects, everything out of it. And so they're really protective organs. And we're gonna get to that in a minute in more detail. Okay, so what we like to do is live image them. And there's a number of different ways to do this. But here we've got our living plants taped to a slide, put under the confocal microscope. We don't leave them there. They don't like it very much, so we put them back in the growth chamber, then put them back on the microscope and image them again. And so here you can get a sense of, here's this growing flower, and here it's a closed bud because we're looking at early developmental stages. So here's one sepal, here's one sepal, here's one sepal. So we're seeing three sepals growing here. And we're seeing the cells, so we're seeing the outline of the cells with the plasma membrane marker and the nuclei, and you can get a sense of growth. And so we're looking at both cell to organ scale here.
What's the time span?
So every 6 hours. And so this whole thing is about 66 hours. Yeah.
So are they all identical? One is inside,
another
is outside?
So this is a very interesting question. Are these sepals identical? No, in some sense. They are not identical. So this one is tucked inside, as you mentioned, and it's a lateral sepal. So we've got the two medial sepals, and those are probably also not identical. And then we have the two lateral sepals on the side. Those, as far as we can tell, are fairly identical. They do end up slightly different sizes, but very similar sizes. So mostly, we've been kind of ignoring the very small differences in sizes. But there is the last mutant I will get to in the end, if we have time, actually shows that these are distinct. Okay, so we can also track the cells and their growth over time using morphographic software created by Richard Smith. And so what you've seen here is the growth, and every cell is marked with a color, and then all its daughter cells are marked with the same color. So you can see clonal lineages of cells, like this patch here, or this patch. You can also see some of these cells are not dividing, and they're just growing big. Okay, so the central question is, how is organ size controlled? And how does an organ stop growing when it reaches the right size? And does it actually measure its size? So we have all these fundamental questions. And spoiler alert, I'm not going to answer them for you. they're still pretty open, but I'm going to show you where we've got to. And we kind of got to other answers than this. Okay, so if you want to know how organ size is controlled, the classic way of doing this is a mutant screen, if you're a geneticist like me. Yeah?
Before you go to genetics, simple experiments like removing a sepal whether the other one is compensated, has it been done?
We have tried that experiment. We have slightly mixed results from that. So we've removed one sepal. The other ones overgrow very slightly, but not a lot. So it seems, and that's how also I'm using organ in this context. So it seems mostly sepal specific. There may be some contact inhibition that's allowing some slight adjustment, but it's not large scale, at least from our fairly from the results we have. Yeah. Okay, so you can do mutant screens. And you can get, larger or smaller organs, leaves, sepals, whatever, petals. And there's been a lot of work that's done, and you pull out all these genes, and you do not need to know these. You don't even need to read them. But what you can see is we've got sort of cell expansion and cell proliferation and a lot of things feeding in and sort of something. And if you look at this like me, I'm like, well, I have no idea what just happened here. I have no idea how this actually specifies an organ size. We've got a good parts list, and that's important. We got to start there. But as we were discussing last night, a parts list doesn't get us to how is something happening, and that's really what's missing here. Is how, what's the conceptual logic? Is there, are these things doing anything sensing size, or what are they doing? How are they controlling size? Okay, so that's our problem. We've got some parts, and we don't have an answer. But I will say most of our parts so far are understanding is they're affecting cell division or cell expansion. So that seems like a reasonable place to start, right? And I'll tell you, it's very, very complicated. So if we take this from a very simplistic example, right? So We've got a theoretical organ here with a few cells in it. If we increase the cell number, we should get a bigger organ, right? If we increase the cell size, we should get a bigger organ. And no, the plant is too smart for us. So if we increase the cell number, it tends to compensate and make smaller cells and make approximately the same size organ. And if we increase the cell size, it compensates and gives us fewer cells, generally speaking. And the organs are fairly close to the same size. So this has been bedeviling plant biologists for a long time.
So this is by playing specifically with mutants that affects cell cycle, essentially?
Yes, generally speaking.
So in animals it's the same, but if you play with like growth pathway, then it's different, right?
Yeah, so that is actually, I think, the conclusion. So what you can go to from this is two possible outcomes. One is that they're actually measuring their size, and so it doesn't really matter. It's not counting cell size or cell number, it's measuring size. The other is that it's really controlling growth, and that's somewhat separable from division. And I think that's the side I'm on with this one. Yeah?
What about wild type? What is the distribution of sizes? Does it correlate with cell number, with cell size, with known?
Yeah, so wild type's been... So let's get to the actual images. Okay, so here is that in real biology as opposed to a schematic diagram. Here is wild type, and it has quite a distribution of cell sizes. So it has these giant cells false-colored in red down to much smaller cells. And we do have a characterization of the cells and the cell sizes through image processing, and there's just quite a range. If we genetically manipulate the cell cycle, we can make it almost all big cells or all small cells, and as you see, we're not having much effect on the organ size. If we quantify that here, here's sepal area, here's these genotypes in order, you can see not much is happening. So this goes back to the idea that it's either growth or size sensing or both that's really the important one, not cell cycle. How do
the other thing that's confusing in plants is people define it in two ways, one of which is carbon biomass accumulation and the other is size, which is quite often just water. So the guy on the left probably has quite a lot less carbon than the guy on the right.
I'm not sure it does. Okay, because the guy on the left has undergone... Okay, so as Adeline's pointing out, there are two different kinds of growth, and they're both... They're complicatedly interrelated, and so I would call them cytoplasmic growth versus vacuolar growth. So adding carbon would be the cytoplasmic growth. You're actually generating more mass of stuff. Water, you're just filling up your big vacuole. I think cytoplasmic growth is quite important and has been massively undervalued in the plant field because people just go, oh, it's just the vacuole. I don't buy it. So these cells, now we're on a diversion, but these cells have undergone endoreduplication where they're replicating their DNA and not dividing. I think that correlates just fine with cytoplasmic growth of mass. I think that it doesn't matter if it's doing that or doing the cell cycle, it's adding that cytoplasmic mass. But these are very complicatedly interrelated, and I don't, that is one of the big questions in the field is how does this play out into the ultimate size? And it's not obvious to me, at least. Namely.
Can you clarify about the growth, that cell growth versus the organ growth? Because in the past slides, the organ size didn't change, but the cell, each cell, in case of a fewer number of cell division, they grew much more. Mm-hmm. Right? So you're talking about organ level growth control rather than...
Well, so I'm asking the question, is there an organ-level growth control, and what form does it take, or is it at the cell level, but it's not through cell division is what we're eliminating right here. It can't possibly be through simplistic cell cycle, cell division stuff. But that is the key multi-scale aspect of this problem, is how do you go from cell to organ scale? And so I'm not considering one or the other. I've got to consider both simultaneously. Dirk.
So is it possible to kind of go
Yeah, so you're raising a very interesting point, which I didn't tell you. These cells are only on the outer layer. And so, yeah, it may be important where you're changing the cells. We don't know the answer to that, but that's entirely possible. Yeah.
So if you increase growth rate, do you see that the organ stops at its normal size? In other words, is there a measurement of having reached a certain size or mass which would be revealed by changing the growth rate and nonetheless having normal organ size?
So I guess the question is, how do you change growth rate? And that's not entirely obvious. So the TOR pathway is conserved in plants. If you mutate it, you do get smaller organs. It's not well understood beyond that what's going on with the TOR pathway. So I mean, and I actually think, and we're not there yet, but I think that's really where we need to go, is where, how do we manipulate growth on that level, on that like ribosome biogenesis scale, and see where we go.
So the TOR pathway, of course, is a nutrition sensing, right? So the statement is, right, it makes as similar phenotypes as right, nutritional, well, as starvation, right, in animals. But, so here, the plants don't respond to starvation.
So what I'm saying is the TOR, so we don't know a lot about that. I mean, plants are biosynthesizing their own energy. But you can still put them in the dark.
Nitrogen.
So they respond to all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And they have sugar sensing and they have all these kinds of things. TOR pathway is not well understood in plants. There are like 3 papers maybe. Mm-hmm. And you know, you mutate it and you get smaller organs. And there are fewer ribosomes. Like, and this is the limit of our understanding in plants, as I understand it. You could add something more.
I think there are more than 3 papers, but they don't make any sense yet.
Okay. So there have been some added, but.
But alternatively, so in response to whatever nutritional supplement limitation, is there science for that?
Yeah, if you make the plant really, really stressed out, and we'll use that as a generic unhappy due to these things, The leaves definitely change a whole lot. They tend to be smaller. The flowers are somewhat smaller. The flowers are fairly resistant to that. They try very hard to make the right size flowers because they need to have the right size flowers to self-fertilize. So they are a little bit smaller, but they're not a lot smaller. The leaves are massively smaller. You can get these dinky little plants, very shrimpy, and then they'll put up almost normal size flowers. Yeah. These ones, I don't see any difference in the timing, any obvious difference in the timing, but we are going to get to timing. So, yeah, let's move on and get there. Okay. So why, you know, why is this? Well, it seems if we look at our cell lineages and measure the growth of a whole cell lineage and ignore cell division, we get a growth curve like this. So we've got time, we've got change in size, and we're getting essentially an S curve. And if we look at when this lineage underwent cell division, it underwent cell division here, here, and here, you can see that doesn't change at all the S curve of their growth. And so, again, it comes back to this idea that cell cycle is not the thing that's manipulating this. If we put that together of more than one cell lineage and look over a whole bunch, so we've got time and change, with change in size, and look at these 3 curves here. We've got the red one is all cells, the purplish one is non-dividing cells, and the green one is dividing cells, and you can see they almost completely overlap. So we're not getting something changing based on division. So that's what we've just been discussing. It seems it's probably growth, not division. Okay. So we know it's not counting cell size or cell number. We've got to have something more fundamental than that, probably growth. So so we confronted this literature and we said, okay, well, what if we try a different approach to this? if there is some kind of size sensing thing, if you mutate it, what you'd kind of expect to get is variably sized organs, because you've now lost this control, and so you should not have as tightly controlled organ size, and so what should you get is variability. So this was our attempt, where my lab came into this, where we say, how do you get organs with consistent size and shape? And in wild type, organs really are consistent size and shape. So here's our flowers, they're all the same. Here's cute little mice with their ears. You can quibble about whether an ear is an organ, but whatever. You don't see things like this, where you get, you know, weirdly sized sepals and petals. And you don't see things very often with mice with one bigger ear. So if there's an organ size sensor, maybe it's involved in maintaining this reproducibility, not specifically setting size. And so this comes back to the point earlier, is how do organs form with reproducible shape and size? And this is a very, you know, fundamental question, as I said, in all multicellular organisms. It has to do with, like, how are our two arms the same length? You know, when we're born, our arms are the same length, and when we grow to maturity, our arms are the same length. They did a lot of growth during that phase, and they're, you know, still the same length. If we look at sepals, it's pretty much the same thing. So now we're looking down on an inflorescence, so that's all the flowers developing. The youngest flowers are near the middle, the oldest flowers are near the edge. And you can see we get very tiny balls, which are the four sepals completely enclosing the flower. And they grow a lot, and they maintain that closure until the flower blooms. And so you've got, they've got to be able to maintain constant size to fulfill their function, which is enclosing and protecting the reproductive organs inside. You can see these are all perfectly closed. They're not letting anything in there to attack and eat, preferably not eat the reproductive organs. Okay. And so here's the four sepals at the end. You can see they're pretty much the same size. These two are the laterals. They're a little more pointy. Okay. And this is even more complicated. So if you actually quantify the size by the outline, if they come out within fairly narrow constraints, I'll show you the quantification. Relatively speaking, narrow. If we group them by immediately which sepal is which, then they get even narrower tolerances, of course. So this is even more of a difficult question because the cells are very highly variable. So we've got, as we pointed out before, these giant cells and small cells. So we've got cell size variability. If we look at the growth rates, and here we've got a heat map where things are growing fast or slow, and here's a young developing sepal, and you can see in red there's fast, and there's fast growth right next to slow growth. So we've got a ton of variability in growth rate. Plant cell growth at some level is controlled by the stiffness of the cell wall. So it cannot expand unless that cell wall yields and allows it to expand. So the stiffness is important. This is atomic force microscopy, where done by Mathilde Dumont and Arezki Buru's lab. And we've outlined the cells with black, and she's just taken sparse points where she's measured the stiffness. And stiff is in red, soft is in blue, and you can see there's just a ton of variability even within a single cell of soft and stiff spots. So tons of variability on the small scale. How do you get consistency on the large scale? Okay, and so this was a question that fascinated a group of us, and I should say I first met Arezki at the 2009 KITP meeting here. And okay, it took several years before the collaboration took off, but that was one of the big outputs of this meeting. So the group is Arezki Buru's group and Olivier Hamant's group at ENS Lyon, my group at Cornell, Richard Smith, who's been at the Max Planck Institute for Plant Breeding, and Chunbyu Lee, who was at Hokkaido University and is now in Stockholm University. And this has been a fantastic collaboration, and even though the funding's done, we're trying to keep it going because we've had so much fun. So our strategy on my lab, which we're the developmental biologists in this, is to screen for mutants with variable size and shape in the same flower. This was done by my former postdoc, Dr. Leland Hong, and here's just a few of the mutants that I'm going to tell you about today. So here's wild type. You can see these sepals are approximately the same size. Here's variable organ size in shape 1, and you can see very different sizes. Here's VOS2, slightly different sizes, and here's VOS3. Now, VOS3 is a little bit different. It's giving us shape variability. We're getting weird lumps on the sepals, but I think it's interesting. So I'm going to try to tell you 3 stories today. We'll see if we get to all 3 or only the first couple. About these mutants, we're going to go out of order. We're going to start with VOS1, then we're going to go to VOS3 and go to VOS2. Okay, so VOS1. If we look at VOS1 at early stages, so here's wild type while the flower's still closed. Here are 3 different VOS1 flowers from the same plant. You can see some are perfectly normal. That flower's closed. Here's one where we've got a smaller sepal here, an almost normal size sepal, and a medium sepal. Here's one where we've got, again, almost normal sepal, smaller sepal, medium sepal. So we have a ton of variability here. We can have all kinds of different things, and the consequence is that flower is not closed. Now, in our growth chamber, it's doing okay anyway, but probably not so good outside. Here's at the later stage when the flower is blooming. Again, you can see the same thing. So we have some perfectly normal looking flowers, some completely abnormal looking flowers, and some in between. Yeah.
Can you stage these and ask if the variability is always to the smaller size?
If it's always to the smaller size, yes. Here we go. So we quantify that and ask, you know, exactly this. Where's the variability? So this is at a certain stage, but it holds for other stages as well. So wild type has a fairly tight range of sizes, and it's a little bit loose because we've combined all the sepals. And as I said, it'd be tighter if we went sepal by sepal. But, you know, that's fairly tight, especially if you compare it to VOS1, where you can see it's much more variable. Now, what we ideally would have liked is things where the mean is the same, and we get things even bigger and things even smaller. We have not gotten that. None of our mutants have that. Most of our mutants are like this. So the mean is smaller, and there's a much, much larger range there. So that is what came out. So maybe it is what it is. The shape is also more variable. So if we take the outlines and superimpose them. Here's wild type outline superimposed, and we can get like an average outline in red. And we're normalizing for size here. So we're taking out the size part of it. You can see tightly constrained in VOS1, much less tightly constrained. Again, we can quantify this and say this is a measure of the variation in size, and it's higher in VOS1. So when does this defect happen? It happens at pretty later stages. So if we look when the sepals are initiating, so here's our very baby flower. It's got the 4 sepals initiating. You can't see the one that's under here. So these little lumps are the sepals. They initiate, this is wild type. They grow out and they cover the flower, and that's the very first thing that happens, right? Because their goal is to protect the flower. And then they keep growing in concert with the internal organs. But they keep that flower tightly closed. Here's VOS1, sepals initiate fine, grow out fine, and when they start to close is when we start to have problems. You can see there's a gap there. This sepal's lagging behind, this sepal's lagging behind, leaving gaps. And so we're having a problem not in initiation, but in the growth of these sepals. So while we were doing this, Oreski's lab was taking a theoretical approach to this, and we thought these projects were going to be separate, and then they converged in a beautiful way. So he was thinking about how do you go with all this variability and stiffness and get a regular organ out of it. And so this is the work of Mathilde, his graduate student. And so they made a model where it's a finite element model. It's a continuous sheet, and they have, you know, triangles in it, essentially. And they can make spots, variable spots of stiff and soft. So the stiff spots are in black, the soft spots are in essentially white or light gray. And here's our sepal, and they can calibrate the variability in stiff and soft based on their atomic force microscopy data. And so they put that into a primordium and they let it grow. And they get a mess. I always think this one looks like a nose. I think it's very funny. But you can see the soft spot massively overgrew. These stiff spots are really constraining things. So we have the variability in space that they see. We do see this variability, and yet you cannot get a sepal out of it. So they run it again and again. So these are from different random starting points, and you can get things that look sort of like Drosophila wing discs, and like maybe a wing that's partly out, but nothing that looks like a sepal. Okay, so we've got a problem. So variability in space is not enough, but we know we do see that. So they said, well, what if maybe this isn't consistent in time. Maybe the spots are soft and then stiff and then soft, and so they let it change in time. And this is a purely random. There's like selecting the stiffness each time from a random distribution. But you can see it made a nice sepal. So they run it again and again, and they get a nice sepal each time. So it's variability in space and time is giving us regular sepals. Okay, so they had this model, we had our data, and the question is there anything to this? In our virtual sepal, cellular variability, and cellular is a slight overstatement, in space and time is giving us regular organ morphology. What happens in the sepal? Yes. So, yes, we do have, okay, so this is a very simple model. It starts as a half sphere. We do put in underlying anisotropy into the mechanics of the tissue to make it get to the right shape, because otherwise it doesn't get to the right shape at all. So there is underlying anisotropy. Yeah. Yeah.
So the other thing is that obviously in the sepal, the growth rates vary across the sepal and the band, that there's a relatively narrow band that's growing fast.
And we have completely ignored that. Yeah. No, that is entirely ignored in this model, and that is really one of the future. So in the growth, you will see this, and this is one of the things, and the stochasticity is really only happening properly in the fast-growing zone, but it's a model. But this is one of the things I want to get to in the future is how do we get these growth zones right, and how do they influence this? Yeah. You hit the nail on the head, right? So what it's doing is spatial temporal averaging of the noise. If you start with a uniform model, you can get a uniform sepal just fine. So then the question is, do you need this? The plant seems to do it. And okay, so if we want to get into my philosophical mode where there's no justification whatsoever, I would say that yes, there's a reason the plant's doing this. It's much easier than trying to make something very uniform. This poor plant's out in the environment. It might have an insect come along and eat a few cells, kill a few cells here and there. And if it's already quite variable, yeah, well, whatever. You know, things are variable anyway. Some of those cells are stiff, which is equivalent to dead. So I think it kind of gives some robustness in a very changeable, varying environment. But I don't know that, and I would love to test that in the future, of course. So we don't know, so I'm going to get to that in terms of cell growth rates, and we have no idea in terms of protein mass or trigger pressure. But let me get to that in terms of cell growth rates. But, okay.
So I'm wondering if this is a consequence of tiling basically cells of very different sizes. Because also I'm thinking that in plant structures, let's say a roof, you don't put everything the same size, but everything together. You have to tile it in very different sizes.
Yeah, so it is in both leaves and sepals, it's very typical to have these cells of very different sizes. And then the question is, well, why do you do that? I have some answers and not some other answers. And so it may be partly to accommodate that. What you will see, okay, so let's come back to that in a second. Okay, so what we did to address this is to live image the sepals and look at what's going on with the growth. We were actually doing this in parallel. And so here's wild type. We've now staged these, but it's essentially every 12 hours. So you can see up here, we're imaging every 12 hours. Start here, we're looking at this sepal here, and it gets bigger and bigger, good. Here's VOS1, you can see we start here, gets bigger and bigger. You can see this gap happening where the sepals aren't quite growing fast enough to close it very well. So we've got the same phenotype coming out. And now we need to quantify growth rate. And so what we have here is, using morphographics, the quantified growth rate. So here's wild type, and you can see we do have a fast growth zone at this early stage. It's pretty much throughout the sepal, and then it is here in the middle base of the sepal, and we get slower growth at the top. In VOS2, we've got fast growth. It seems to slow down faster. We will come back to that at the end. And what we need to do then is quantify this and ask, how variable is this in space and how variable is this in time? So cellular variability in space, what we're doing is taking a cell and looking at all its neighbors and saying, how different is it? So you can see we have this cell, and this cell happens to be one of these giant cells that's going to be very big. At this stage, it happens to be growing very fast. At the next stage, it's growing very, very slow. We'll get to that. But you can see it's growing very different rates from two neighbors. Okay, it was growing very fast. Now it's growing very slow. This cell slows down. Half of this cell speeds up. Half of this cell slows down when the division. So there is variability going on. So we need to quantify that. So that's the sense of what we're doing. Okay, so here, what we're doing is we're taking a cell. Quantify variability in space. We take a cell, all of its neighbors, and calculate the difference in growth rate, and then we do that over the whole sepal for each cell, and then we average that. And so we get a value for spatial variability. And that's on the y-axis. We've got high variability versus low variability, and then we've got time here in terms of 12-hour stages. And we've got wild type, three different flowers in blue, and VOS1, four different flowers in magenta. And what you can see is that, generally speaking, the wild type has higher spatial variability, which means difference in growth rates between different cells, than VOS1 does. Yeah?
Does this mean that the neighboring cells are indifferent to the growth of fast-growing neighbors?
Indifferent in that they don't change. Okay. Yeah. They are somewhat indifferent in that they don't change their growth rate to match their neighbors. They are somewhat, since these cells are glued together with their cell walls, which is what you're getting at, it has to, in that segment of cell wall where the two neighbors are glued together, that thing is growing at the same rate because it can't do anything else. So I didn't realize there could be such differences in growth rate when I started looking at this, and I was really shocked by this because I thought, okay, it's got to be more uniform. Somehow, it's because they've got degrees of freedom with multiple different neighbors that they can still have very different growth rates, which is surprising.
A follow-up question is there a way to... So would you expect, because I have more rigid cell walls or cytoskeletons, to kind of have more uniform growth rates?
So we have looked at that. That is where we're going in the future to some extent. It's not coming out nice and clean, so I don't have a good answer for that one yet. Yeah, of course.
Force brain a little bit, right? Clearly, growth rate has to be correlated between cells very strongly, because otherwise this thing wouldn't be flat, right?
Yep.
So, but the data says that individual cells fluctuate, so how about you take the cell and all the cells that touch it, and so on, right? So you can there'll be an isotropic regions. And the question is, how far do you have to go before variability falls off by that portion?
So the scale of the variability. We have some calculations on that, and I do not, so like the, yeah, the long scale correlations. Are there long scale correlations in growth? So Oreskes's lab is looking at this in much more detail. He's got a postdoc, Antoine, who's been looking, calculating long scale correlations. He does see long scale correlations even to sepal scale. And now we're, what we haven't done, so we see that in wild type, we haven't done is looked in the mutants yet. He's, you know, trying to work up to look in the mutants and see how that changes. But yes, there are long scale correlations. The other interesting thing is if we, so this variability is averaging out, it really is, and we're going to get to that in a little bit. But if we take our cell outlines and then grow the thing uniformly in the computer, and look at how different is that from the cell, like over like 60 hours, something like that. How different is that from the cell outlines if we actually take the real ones? They match pretty well. So it, all of this variability we're seeing is averaging. They're curved. So they are curved. So, but flat is a good approximation. I'll give flat. Yeah.
Come back to Boris's question. If you average over 10 cells, is it now uniform? Are you single cells, but now if you average over 5, 10, 20 cells, when is it actually spatially uniform?
Okay. We don't. So I think the temporal variability is more important than the spatial variability. We did look at that. We didn't get, we didn't get to uniform. Oh, what did we do? I don't remember exactly. We did look at that. It didn't come out with something super interesting. Let's put it that way. That's why I don't remember it. Yeah.
Have you checked the risk?
So the petals are interesting. They initiate early, but they don't grow until much later. But the other internal organs, so the stamens, seem to be right up against the sepals. And so there is a question of, is there any correlation there? I don't know the answer to that. Paul? You are jumping too far ahead. Let me get there. No, good. I mean, these are the two questions, but it is, but we got to get there. Okay. Yeah. Can we get there? Okay. Okay. So variable in space, the variability in time when we measure that. So we've got temporal variability and time. They're more overlapping. I still think wild type's more variable. This is not showing it. There you have it. If we look at variability in stiffness, VOS1 has less spatial variability in stiffness. So here's wild type. It's got higher variability, spatial variability in stiffness than VOS1.
Can you compare the variability between pixels or between cells?
So we're looking at pixels. So actually when we're comparing this, it's not per cell, it's per like 30 pixels. So we didn't consider exactly cells, but we considered a group of pixels. So wild type is highly variable in space and time. We get regular sepals. In the mutant, we can detect lower variability in space, about the same variability in time, and we get irregular sepals. So what happens if we put this into the model? If we have variability in space, and time in wild type, we get fairly regular sepals. If we decrease the variability in space by making the spot size larger, we get more irregular sepals in the model. So.
Is the spot size actually larger in the thing, or is it just the spots are more consistent? Like if you take a correlation length, is it actually longer?
The correlation length. I don't remember the underlying implementation. The correlation length is longer. Yes. So we have cellular variability in space and time gives us regular organ morphology. So we're getting to the question of growth direction. And if we look at the principal direction of growth, and we have this green cell, and then it grows to be this red cell, we can make an orientation of the growth, and that's the principal direction. Now, of course, there's also the minor direction, and we're not showing that here. So in wild type, we have quite a bit of variability in the direction of growth. And you can see here's over 24 hours, you can see quite a bit of variability. Here's the next 24-hour period, quite a bit of variability. But what's really interesting is if we look at the growth, the cumulative growth over the whole 48 hours, then we're getting much more regularity. So this is this whole averaging out. It's averaging out the stochasticity. So we can see that here. This cell is growing a little to the right. It's growing a little bit to the left. That averages out straight up. And I'm not saying every cell is growing a little to the right, a little to the left. I'm saying averages out. So yes, the cellular variability is undergoing spatial temporal averaging to give us regular organs. In the mutant, this is not happening. So we've still got variability in the orientation in the first 24 hours, variability in the orientation in the second 24 hours, but when we look over the whole 48 hours or even longer, it doesn't average to straight up. So it's blocked its averaging capabilities. So this cell is growing a little bit to the right, still quite to the right. And so, of course, that averages to the right. Yes?
So if you were to look at the distribution of cell sizes, let's say in wild type, and compared to me, is it fair to say that in the wild type is not stereotypical? Meaning that you don't always have big cells in one area and so on and so forth, but actually the type randomly versus the mutant.
We don't detect any obvious differences in the cell size patterning in the wild type and the mutant. On average, the mutant cells in the end get a little bit bigger, and it's probably part of this compensation phenomenon going on. But we're not detecting a cell size patterning defect here in terms of having different cell, not, at least not an obvious one, let's put it that way. And we have measured it. We don't detect something jumping out at us. So if we put this in like a schematic, we've got variable growth direction in the first 24 hours, still variable in the second 24 hours. Spatial temporal averaging makes it cumulative growth uniform. Okay, so why is cellular variability reduced and spatial temporal averaging blocked in VOS1 mutants? So we're getting to Paul's question here. And VOS1 is a mutation in a mitochondrial protease. So it's called FTSH4 in Arabidopsis. It's got a transmembrane domain, it's got a AAA ATPase domain, and a protease domain. It sits, so here's FTSH4, this is VOS1. It sits on the inner membrane of the mitochondria, facing the inner membrane space, and it's kind of a garbage collector. So it's actually going along and degraded any kind of unfolded proteins. So maintaining protein quality control, it also helps them fold properly if they're unfolded, but yeah, not a beautiful developmental regulator like we were expecting, right? Okay, so how do we go from this to where we're going? And so we've got mitochondrial defects. Okay, so we've got our VOS1 mutation gives rise to mitochondrial defects, and this is published by other people. And how does that go to reduce spatial temporal averaging and variable sepal size? So one thing that happens with mitochondrial defects is you get increased reactive oxygen species. And particularly this one is affecting the quality control in the OxPhos pathway, so it's definitely giving rise to reactive oxygen species. And so reactive oxygen species are these things we're supposed to take antioxidants to defeat. So this is hydrogen peroxide, this is one of them, this is superoxide, this is another one. And they're known to be both damaging agents and signaling agents in both plants and animals. So we looked at reactive oxygen species in both wild type and mutant, And what you can see is wild type, there's fairly low levels. In the mutant, there's much, much higher levels. And they're also much more variable and much, so you get sometimes like very high expression, and this correlates with this very small sepal here. And so you can see variable and starting much earlier. So this comes to Paul's first question. FGSH4, as far as we can detect, is expressed very broadly. We don't see any specificity in the expression pattern. We do see variability in the ROS pattern generated by this mutant. So that doesn't mean, so there is some non-uniformity here going on. And this is contributing to the non-uniformity of sepals, I'm sure. So to the second, okay, so is reactive oxygen species causing this phenotype? What we can do is we can take wild type flowers and treat them with hydrogen peroxide and see if we generate the same phenotype. And so that's what we've done here. And we've got, so here's our wild type flower without any hydrogen peroxide. These are three treated with hydrogen peroxide, and we can get fairly similar phenotypes. So this one has sort of a range of sepal sizes, all on the smaller side. This one has some normal and some really small sepals. This one looks a lot like FGSH4, so like normal and smaller. It takes exactly the right concentration to get this. If you treat with too high a concentration, you're dead. You treat low, too low a concentration, like nothing's happening. And we're dipping these plants, so there probably is some variability in how much hydrogen peroxide is penetrating each sepal. So there's definitely some variability thrown in here, but we can get the same phenotype. The next thing we said, well, if this is due to reactive oxygen species, we should be able to reduce or remove this extra reactive oxygen species and recover wild type. So we take our VOS1 plants, we overexpress catalase. Catalase degrades hydrogen peroxide, and we do rescue to, well, normal sepal size. Or sepal shape, regular sepal shape and size. What you can see is these sepals are even a little bit bigger, which is interesting, and we'll get to that. So this comes back to Paul's second question. I mean, the mitochondria are totally screwed up in these things. Why are we attributing this to reactive oxygen species and not everything else? It's because we can get the same phenotypes and rescue the phenotypes. So there probably are other things going on. I mean, the mitochondria really are screwed up, and that does come back to the question of energy homeostasis, and I don't know what's going on. But so far, the important parts are coming out of the reactive oxygen species here. Doesn't mean there's not some other contribution. Yeah. Ah, very good. We're getting there. Just give me 1 second. So that's exactly where we're going. So what really intrigued me was actually, Paul, did you want to ask something first? Or okay. Actually what's going on in wild type. So it's not that there's no reactive oxygen species in wild type. It comes on at the tip of the sepals and then progresses down the sepals. And that is very similar to what's going on with the growth rate. So we have first fast growth, and it slows down from the tip, and we still have this fast growth zone, but the sepals getting larger, so we have more and more slow growth, and then it finally terminates. And so there's a parallel in this pattern that was really intriguing to me. And so that raised the question of, is ROS actually a, slow growth, mature signal? And so our hypothesis is, if ROS is acting as this signal terminating growth in wild type, then reducing ROS should increase sepal size. And so here's the answer to your question. If we reduce ROS two different ways, we get bigger sepals. So here's wild type. Here we've overexpressed ascorbate peroxidase, which is one ROS degrading enzyme. Here we've overexpressed catalase 2, both larger sepals. You can see that. Here's the graph of that. We've got sepal area, wild type. Both of these are larger. If we increase ROS by overexpressing an NADPH oxidase generates ROS, we do get smaller sepals. So far that holds. Now, I should say, in these sepals, we haven't completely gotten rid of ROS. We've lowered it, but we haven't completely gotten rid of it. So we don't know what would happen if we completely got rid of it. And it still accumulates in approximately the same pattern as wild type, just a bit delayed. Yeah, Arlene.
So I am. My memory, which may be wrong, is that ROS is required for lignification for all that lovely cross-linking, and you've got the ROS pattern in the xylem or associated with the vasculature in the way that's happening out in the.
Yep.
So is this really just about rigidification triggered by lignification of the vasculature? Can you mess with vascular development and get the same effect?
So this is one of the questions for the future, is where does this ROS come from? And one of the possibilities is from this vasculature lignification. And in a sense, we're, next slide, basically. I don't have an answer for you, but this is the question. So the conclusions of this first part, we've got spatial temporal averaging of cellular variability giving rise to organ regularity. And you know, to physicists, I get the sense you're like, yeah, of course, there's spatial temporal averaging. To biologists, the idea that this was happening in biology, orchestrated by the plant somehow, by having variability, was quite new to me. So then we have the idea that ROS are inhibiting spatial temporal averaging in the mutant, and ROS are a major signal inducing maturation of the sepals and termination of growth. Now the question is, how are ROS inhibiting spatial temporal averaging? And we're just kicking the can down the road and being like, okay, well, if ROS are the signal, where are they coming from? What is turning them on at this time? What is it? And so are they coming from the vasculature? Are they coming from other sources? I don't know the answer. And it could be. You do see the vascular chase there. So it might be just the vasculature has decided it's time. But then how does the vasculature know? Yeah, Paul. You're saying in the mutant?
Yeah.
We do not know. Actually, yeah, we don't know what they're doing. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's an interesting possibility. And how does that play into this? Yeah.
There's all this confusion in plants because a lot of the ATP will be coming from phage synthesis in the plant, but so the role of mitochondria in generation is kind of problematic in that it's not zero.
So these are generally in continuous light. However, we do see varying effects with varying light treatments. And the severity is, it's more severe with less light. So there could be a role. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Lower the temperature. We have not done that. I don't know what would happen with temperature. Temperature plays a role with auxin, which makes it very complicated. Because auxin controls everything in plants. Yeah, Dirk. Let me come to that in just a second with some other speculation. So, you know, one of the things here is this spatial temporal averaging, and is this a developmental principle that's used in multiple different systems? And I just want to give you an example from Drosophila, from a very different kind of system. So, if you have, this is based on Little et al., and if you have hunchback gene expression, we all know gene expression at the mRNA level is stochastic, but you get very nice, beautiful, uniform hunchback protein. So how does this happen? There's actually spatial temporal averaging of the hunchback transcription in space and time. So in space going up, diffusing because this is a syncytium, and in time because you've got stochasticity in the timing of transcription that gives you this. So there's another very different system where there's a lot of variability that's doing spatial temporal averaging. So I'm intrigued by the idea of ROS as a kind of ancient signal. There's a lot of systems where ROS is actually inhibiting cell division. And there's this speculation from Mittier et al, where they're thinking of early cells and the idea that early cells at first needed to buffer ROS because it's very damaging to them. So they started out buffering it, and then you can think that, ROS can be used as a signal to figure out your energy homeostasis. So then they would start having a simple signal transduction to tune and scavenge the ROS. And then you can start saying, well, if there's something near me generating ROS, maybe it's another active cell. And so you can start thinking that with interaction with other organisms or cell-to-cell communication, and then you're going to add more signaling pathways. And then active ROS production could be an advantage to actually signal to other cells, so then cells generated ways of producing ROS besides mitochondria. And so our current is that we've got this very complicated system of ROS production and scavenging pathways in a very complex signal transduction network. So it's an interesting signal in the standpoint that it's very universal. It does signal a lot in wounding. Wounding is another situation where you need to shut down growth very rapidly. And so maybe it's really a shutdown growth signal, and it's been co-opted by pathogen attack and wounding and also development. That's a speculation, total speculation.
The model you just described is studied a lot in neurons. That's pretty much how neurons is pretty much describe kind of brain functions, actually, at this level.
This model?
Yeah.
Okay.
At many levels. If you look in the reactive oxygen production and signaling pathways inside neurons, and what happens when it goes, the effect on the mitochondria and how it leaks and the damage caused, if it becomes too big in the signaling to the microglia and so on.
It's the same, yeah. Okay, that's cool. So, I mean, there is something that's fairly universal about this. And then the question is, is this universal or is it a co-opted pathway? Or I think it's speculation for the future. Okay. So let's talk about variable organ size 3, and we will not get to variable organ size 2. And variable organ size 3 is actually variable organ shape 3. And what's interesting about this mutant, if we look down on the inflorescence, here you can see wild type is smooth, or flat, as Boris said. And in the mutant, it's no longer smooth and flat. It's got all these wrinkles. So if we look at that, here's scanning electron micrographs, smooth and flat, here in BOS3, very wrinkled. And why we've classified it as a variability mutant is that the morphology from sepal to sepal is quite variable. And so that's why we put it in this category. Mostly we thought it was quite interesting and came out of our screen. So the wrinkles are only on the outer side. If we look at the inner side of the sepal, it's also smooth. And if we do a cross-section through the sepal, so here's a cross-section. We've got the wild type, we've got the outer side, we've got the inner side. You can see both are smooth. Here's BOS3, inner side is smooth, outer side has these wrinkles in it. This is in the sepal. If we look at the leaves, wild type leaves are also smooth. BOS3 leaves are smooth, but they curve the wrong direction. So they've still got a problem. But they're not making full-on wrinkles. Okay. So how do these folds arise on the BOS3 sepal? And our hypothesis is that there's a problem coordinating growth across the sepal. We have like the outer two layers in wild type need to coordinate. If we slightly uncoordinate them and make the outer side or the bottom side grow faster, then we're going to get upcurling leaves. And if we massively uncoordinate it, then we're going to get this wrinkling that we see in the sepals, is our hypothesis. And the question is how? How do you get these folds? Well, there's two possibilities, local outgrowth or buckling. Or I would add a third possibility, combination. And the question is this local outgrowth or buckling? So we image the sepals as they're developing and look at the fold generation. So here's wild type again. Here we're going every 24 hours. Here's the BOS3 mutant. You can see it starts off smooth. So it's smooth, it's smooth. And now we're starting to get these wrinkles forming, and now you're starting to see like a lump and wrinkles forming. So if we look at that with Gaussian curvature, if you have a saddle shape, it's going to be negative Gaussian curvature in blue. If you have a convex shape, it's going to be positive in red. So here's wild type, you can see. So here's the sepal. There's a saddle shape at the junction between sepals. But the outer surface of the sepal is basically always positive Gaussian curvature. And then in the mutant, you can see we start to get these saddle shapes coming where the creases are happening. So there's a saddle shape here and a saddle shape here that correspond with where we're getting these folds happening. So how is growth altered in BOS3 to give rise to the folds? So we looked at this again using morphographics so we can measure growth rates. In wild type, they start off high and they go a little bit lower, and then we start to get the zoned with slow growth at the tip. In the mutant, starts off high, goes a little bit lower, and stays relatively high compared to wild type. Now what's interesting is we're not seeing real fast growth here in the middle, that this is going to be the folded out part. And before we get these folds, we don't see real slow growth. So we're not seeing zoned growth to give us these folds. Afterward, we do start to see slow growth in the fold. But we're not seeing, like, before it happens, differences in growth rate. And how about cell division? Is cell division playing into this? If we look at cell division, so we've now got the number of daughter cells derived from one early cell. So the more red it is, the more daughter cells there are. As you can see in wild type, we've got patches where there's a ton of daughter cells. And the mutant, there's a bit fewer cell divisions. And again, we're not seeing something where there's a very clear pattern here, where like there's lots of cell divisions where it might be growing out and few cell divisions where it's in. Okay. So we're not seeing something obvious in terms of like outgrowth so far. Now we know that auxin regulates everything, but auxin specifically regulates the outgrowth of primordia in the plant. And so does auxin signaling correlate with this formation? So we've got a reporter for auxin. It's the red nuclei. Here's a time, again, over time. So this is one of our BOS3 sepals. We've got the signal at the tips. That's very typical. We start to get one of these folds and outgrowths here, and we do not see any DR5 in it, any auxin signal. Again, we don't see it here. This is not a perfect marker. It doesn't mean for sure it's not there, but we're not seeing it. Okay, so we're not getting a lot of evidence for local outgrowth. What about buckling? And buckling is bending or giving way under pressure or strain. I'm sure you guys know this better than I do, but, you know, to get us all on the same page. I like this one because this is a train track that buckled during an earthquake. So Oreski Burud made a model, and I can give you the equations later, but I didn't put them in here. Where we've got a three-layered tissue. We've got the outer, inner, and middle. And the question is, what kind of, this whole thing's expanding, so what kind of properties of this tissue do you have to get buckling on this outer side that's going against the curvature? So it's a pretty unique system. And so what he found from this model is that you have to have the outer epidermis grow faster. So, sorry, I've got a planty term there, but you've got to have this outer epidermis grow faster and it has to be softer. So both faster and softer. Yeah, Dominique.
Any assumptions about the connection between this and the internal layer?
So in this, this is not the actual model, this is a hand drawing of it. We do have some kind of connection, but we've got oppressed mechanical layers. But there's, we'd have to go in to ask Oreski about the real details there.
This layer is spongy. I was just wondering, you know, in a leaf that you'd have a sort of palisade layer and a spongy layer, and their connections to the outside could be different, and whether the sepal have that same arrangement.
The arrangement in the sepal is not quite so clear as that, at least as far as we've seen. We do, so when we look at the buccal, sometimes there are like what look like air pockets in them, and then the cells seem to move into them, the inner cells, so it may detach a little bit.
It's not the case generically that in elasticity buckling of this kind that we need the outer layer to be anything like softer than the inner layer. In fact, engineers studying extremely hard surfaces like diamond coatings that buckle off other things.
Yeah, so it's not, okay, so this is not a general buckling thing at all. This is a very specific to this circumstance buckling. And it's very specific to this circumstance where you've got a very odd buckling because you've got a curved surface, in fact, and it needs to buckle on the outer side, which would not be, which is fairly hard to generate buckling there. So that's based on Oreskes' calculations, what it would take. Yeah. Okay, so to test this buckling idea, and we're doing a lot more tests of this, and this is an ongoing project, we first started by crossing in a mutant where we're orienting growth and not letting growth be quite as diffusive as it is in the mutant. So we're crossing in one of these mutants we have where we've got all giant cells and the growth is very oriented upward because of them. So we take our wild, our mutant with all giant cells, cross it to the VAS3 mutant with the buckles, with the outgrowths, and what we see is we get smooth. You can see this better here. So here's wild type smooth, here's VAS3, got all these lumps, and here's the double where it's back to smooth. So clearly, at least changing the orientation and possibly rate of growth is sufficient to remove this. Okay, so in conclusion, we've got that you need some kind of balance between the growth on the two different sides of the leaf or sepal to get the smooth surface. We don't see something that looks like the initiation of primordia or like localized outgrowths. Buckling is possible, and we need to do further tests, and maybe you guys can give me some good ideas about what tests. Yeah.
Can you compare the growth
and entropy between the two? So this is our limiting, yeah, so the ideal thing we need to test is can we get the growth, is the growth rate on the outer side faster than the growth rate on the inner side? Compare growth on the two sides. We can't do it in the sepals. We cannot penetrate through to the inner layer. The organ is such that we can't get there. What we've done is, okay. Yeah, let me get to what we've done in a couple more slides because I'm going to tell you what the gene is first. So what gene is mutated in VAS3? It's a transcription factor called asymmetric leaves 2. And it's a promoter mutation that causes this to be ectopically expressed. So we're getting too much of this thing. It's expressed now, it should be only on the inner side, and now it's on the outer side as well. So if we look at the model, it should be only on the inner side, now it's on both the inner and the outer side. So we've now suddenly changed our setup. If we overexpress this AS2 transcription factor on the outer side, artificially ourselves, we do get these lumps and folds. So it's that. So our conclusion is that you really need to have some kind of coordination of growth to get this flat structure. And we can't do it in sepals, but we can do it in cotyledons. So is growth coordinated on the two sides of the organ? So here's a seedling. We've got cotyledons. We can image both the top and the bottom of them. And we've got two different wild-type plants. And so we image the growth rate on the top and on the bottom. Here's wild-type plant number one. You can see the top and the bottom are fairly equal. Here's wild-type plant number two. Top and bottom are also equal. Now, what's interesting is these two plants are growing at different rates, clearly. So, but within a plant, it's equal. So I think that to me was really intriguing, is that the plant is clearly coordinating even if it's growing different rates. Okay, so we are going to skip VAS2 altogether because we are running out of time. And we'll come to the conclusions at the end. So how is organ size controlled? Well, we don't know. What we do know is there's spatial temporal averaging of the noisy cell growth that's involved in producing regular organs. We think we see a very important role for ROS in stopping growth in the sepals. And this is the part I didn't get to. We see a role for the timing of initiation in contributing to organ size. And we do see an importance of coordinating growth across the organ for shape. And so we still don't really know how size is controlled, and we need some new approaches here to get at that. And looking at some of this biogenesis of materials is one of the things for the future, for sure. So I'd like to thank the people who did the work. So my postdoc, Leland, did most of the work I showed you today. Some of the beginning stuff I showed you was done by Dana Robinson and Heather Meyer. We've had fantastic collaborations with Rezki Budud, Olivier Hammond, Richard Smith, and Chunbiu Li and people in their lab. And some of our other collaborations from the early stuff I showed you was with Gerardo Tariello and Petros Komosakos. That collaboration also initiated at the 2009 KITP meeting. It's been fantastic for generating collaborations. The funding for this work was from the Human Frontiers. Sadly, it's over. We have other funding from the NSF. And I really want to thank KITP for these fantastic meetings and how they give us time to think and organize and generate new ideas. And that's something that's very rare to get. So thanks, and I'm happy to take more questions. Yeah, Adeline. Okay, well, Boris first. So, do I have more thoughts about the coordination of two sheets? My more thoughts about the coordination of two sheets is that this mutant is not really telling us how they're coordinated, sadly. Because it's a gain of function mutant, and now we have this transcription factor expressed on the other side, it's a very odd situation. Bumpy, wavy. You can call it all kind of folded, yeah. So what other thoughts are you thinking of?
No, just you skipped it.
Oh, no, I skipped to the next mutant. Yeah, so the next mutant. There is a mutant. I didn't tell you about VOS2. I just skipped it. Okay, are you ready? You want to go back and see VOS2? I can tell you VOS2, at least the first part of VOS2. Everyone good with that? Okay, here we go. Yep. Okay, so the part I skipped, VOS2, the third mutant. And there are a few more mutants that Leland has taken with her to her own lab. So VOS2 is another of these variable organ size mutants, but I think what's quite interesting is it's a very different story from VOS1. So we did not find yet another player in the same pathway, we found something quite different. That's the way it goes with mutant screens. So this was work done by my graduate student, Ming Yuan. And if we look at wild type versus VOS2, again, we see variable sepal size at multiple stages. Again, wild type has fairly constrained sepal size, and VOS2 has, on average, smaller and more variable sepals. So it's very, very similar type of phenotype at the late stage. But what's very different is at the early stage. So remember with VOS1, I told you it wasn't in the initiation of sepals. The sepals initiated just fine. In VOS2, the problem is in the initiation of sepals. So here we have wild type. We've got the floral meristem, and we've got sepal primordia all the way around it. So these lumps are the sepal primordia initiating. And then they're going to grow very rapidly to cover the floral meristem. So by late stage, it's completely closed. Here's VOS2. So here, we've got one sepal primordium that looks normal. We've got two that look a little bit small and delayed, and this one's still missing. This one is going to come up later, we think, and when we know from other flowers, because in the end, we mostly have four sepals. So it's not a sepal number problem, it's a timing. Well, I'm going to show you it's a timing problem. Okay, so we thought this was really intriguing because it is not the same phenotype, and it's suggesting a role for organ initiation. So we've proposed that the sepal initiation is delayed. Is it really? And so if we start with live imaging wild type, here's a wild type flower where you see the initiation of the sepal. So we've got the initiation of all four sepals. You can see they're relatively rapid. I'll show you in the next slide exactly. And here's FOS2. You can see the first sepal initiated fine, and the others are a bit delayed relative to it. Okay, so let's look at that again slower where you can actually see it. We've got wild type, and within 12 hours, you get the... So the first sepal is initiated here just barely, and within 12 hours, you get the other three sepals initiating, and then by 42 hours, it's grown and closed. Here's VOS2, first sepal is initiating, and 12 hours later, the other three have not initiated, but by 42, they have. So clearly delayed. We can quantify that, and so what we're doing is quantifying the timing of initiation. So here we've got the time between the first sepal initiating and the second, the sepal across from it initiating. And this is a histogram. So we've got time and the percent of sepals that initiate at that time. So in wild type, we have 100% of the sepals here in blue initiate 6 hours. 100% of this sepal initiate 6 hours after that sepal. Okay. In VOS2, you can see we've got variable timing. So some initiate in 6 hours, more initiate 12, some 18, 24, 30, 36. So we've got some initiating quite a bit later. If we look at the lateral sepals, the time between the first sepal and the lateral sepals, then in wild type it's always 12 hours. You can see 100% initiating 12 hours. If we overlay then VOS2 in red, you can see that we're getting some in 12 hours, but more 18, 24, and 30. Now what's interesting is we've clearly gotten an inversion. We have some of these sepals initiating at 36 hours, and these ones are already initiated by then. So we've got even a change in order sometimes. Okay, so does delaying initiation cause variable organ size? I've imaged these over a very long time and looked at what happens to the organ size. So wild type, they're starting to initiate. They're all initiated fairly normally. If the flower closes, and you can see regularity. VOS2, we've got this delayed initiation here. And if we continue throughout, you can see that sepal is always, it's not quite closing right. It's still not quite closing right because it's always a bit delayed. So it can't, in this mutant, it can't catch up. So the initiation is really, the timing of initiation is important for the robustness. Yeah, of course. No, it's not. And we have looked at that. I didn't put that in the talk, but that I think that's a very interesting point. So why, we really think that initiation shouldn't matter, right? They should be sensing, we always think about them as sensing their size at maturity and growing to the right size, and this is not doing that. So why not? And that raises the question of, is VOS2 doing something later in that process? When we look at the growth rates in VOS2, they're slower throughout. And so it at least is not able to catch up because it's always got slower growth. So for what it's worth, that's that's what I know so far. So it's really hard to tell whether the initiation of the first one's normal. So far it looks mostly normal. And the trick is that we're using it as a staging marker. So then related to that, we don't have any evidence that it's not normal. Like, we can do things like measure the size of the floral meristem at that size. It's a little, it's not perfect, but it looks much more normal than the others. And so this comes back to the early point. Are these sepals identical? They seem to not be in this mutant. So the first one looks quite normal, and the others, the most severely affected is the one across from the first one, and the two lateral ones are medium affected.
So when you were talking about the lagging one not being slow, so is it slower than the leading one, the first one? Is there a difference in birth rate between the sepals? Everything slowed down.
So I don't have perfect data on that, but the data so far looks like everything slowed down. And so everything slowed down. As far as we can tell proportionately, So it's the timing that still generates the size difference, and then that's proportionately slowed down. You know, maybe in wild type, if it was a little bit late, it would catch up, and these guys can't catch up, and so maybe it's because they just can't even upregulate their growth. I don't know. I don't know that wild type would do that because wild type is perfectly regular, so it's hard to say. But yeah, we don't see a difference in growth rate. We see universally slow, not difference growth rate, so far, at least the evidence so far. Okay, so what gene is disrupted in VOS2? It's a mid-domain transcription factor. And we're going after what's downstream of it a bit. There's a lot of planty details about how this thing is involved in organ initiation. It's super cool for planty people, but since most of you are not planty people, I ditched that. And so our conclusion is that the part that I ditched is VOS2 is involved in coordinating the hormones auxin and cytokinin and stiffness, which is giving rise to the correct initiation of the primordia at the right time. But the key is that this correct initiation that's nearly synchronous, not perfectly, that is giving rise to the organ regularity in this case. And that may be a feature of VOS2's slower growth, but that is what it's revealing to us, is the importance of the timing. And I think this is really quite interesting because, as we discussed before, it's quite different from what we think. You know, we think we should measure at the late stage, and if something's behind, at least from Drosophila, it should delay development until it catches up. And so the beautiful example is the fluctuating bilateral asymmetry, where if a wing disc is having a problem growing, it's going to signal with DILP8, and that's going to block ecdysone, and so the fly can't go until the wing disc is the right size. And if you screw up this pathway, then you start getting this asymmetry, much more like what we get. But this is a late stage, and clearly we're having an effect at an early stage, which is quite interesting to me. Okay, so that's the part we skipped, and so the conclusion from that is that, surprisingly, timing of initiation is contributing, at least in this system, to the organ size control. Okay, good. That's the part. So asymmetric leaves is a transcription factor. It's classically thought to work with another transcription factor, AS1, and is supposed to downregulate other genes. How it's regulating growth is really not understood. So, I mean, that is something we don't know, is how is it just expressing it on this other side actually affecting growth? And that's something to look for in the future. There's been quite a bit of work on AS2, but this particular aspect of it is not understood. So we actually did overexpress it on both sides of the sepal, but the side it's already expressed on doesn't care if you increase it. So it doesn't seem to matter. It's already there. Mutated, we haven't. So we've looked at the mutant, and the sepals are a little bit smaller, but they don't seem to have this weird uncoordinated growth. We haven't done the experiment you're asking for, then overexpress it on both sides in the mutant background. We've only done it in the wild type background. I don't know what would happen in that case. It's a good idea. Yeah.
There's always this discussion about sort of robustness versus evolution. And always strikes me that, you know, as you showed by studying your talk, very closely related species can have widely divergent sizes. And I guess in each of those species it is robust. So essentially, I know you've only put out some ideas, but would you hypothesize which of these you think might be, which can be tuned evolutionarily to change size whilst keeping robustness? Or are they kind of separate ideas? Right? So essentially what I'm asking is, what do you think has been tuning here to change the shape? But as you change the shape, you also want to keep that robustness.
So I think, So I think that's a very interesting question. So little bits of speculation on that. So I think the spatial temporal averaging is a wonderful robustness mechanism that you can keep despite evolution to lower down some of these issues. Some of the other things, in terms of the timing of initiation, I thought that one was interesting, and we started looking for other species that might have differences in timing of initiation, and did that correlate with different organ sizes? And we didn't, the literature, I mean, we looked at SEM, the information is all SEMs as opposed to timing. Sepals do clearly initiate at slightly different times, but we couldn't get a sense of is how different are those times and did it relate to our, so that one strikes me as less, very much less of an opportunity to actually change size. There's been a meta-analysis where they looked at size change in across a whole lot of different plants. I'm not sure exactly how far they went, but and they really found that early, the number of cell divisions early is important. Again, I don't know quite how that fits. So I think there's some very interesting questions there, and you're going to have to maintain the robustness mechanisms and yet also get the size change. And so it's certainly a fascinating question. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question about margin cells. And so the margins between the abaxial and abaxial size of leaves, you've got cells that usually look different. So one is, do you have that differentiation here? And related to that, is it possible that in box two, what you have is actually ectopic margins on that outer face because you've got misspecification of adaxial and abaxial density? Because often you get outgrowth, laminar outgrowth at boundaries, at these boundary faces.
Okay, so the first question is margins. So leaves have these beautiful large cells at the margins. Sepals don't have that cell type, but they do have specific margin cells. They look a bit different from the rest of the leaf. The sepal, they're just kind of small, white, because they don't have any mesophyll in between cells. They're not so characteristic that they're easy to identify as a margin. So when we first cloned this mutant, we put it on the shelf for a few years because they're like, it's another ABAD polarity mutant. There's nothing left to do here. We are still going to check whether it's creating ectopic junctions between abaxial and adaxial polarity, because that is clearly the other hypothesis, then that would be the local outgrowth hypothesis. So we're putting in the markers to check that right now. It's going to take a little bit to get back to you. The reason we picked it off the shelf again is we were intrigued by the growth dynamics so far. And so far it didn't fit with those classic ABAD outgrowths. But that is an open question. Is it really generating that way? Mm-hmm. Have that. So another possibility that I think would be quite interesting is, does it first buckle and then generate that? So I don't think these are mutually exclusive possibilities. And so, yeah, we need a little bit more evidence to get there. And that is one of the ongoing, well, we're trying to get the marker lines into it to see what's going on there. Hopefully there's something besides just that, or we don't have anything to say here, although, yeah, we'll probably publish it anyway, right? Okay, yeah, anyway.
So the second mutant, the phenotype is a little bit similar to the failed modeling that you showed for the first mutant? The one that was creating nose and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how's the loss in the second mutant?
So good question. So in the second mutant, VOS3, the spatial temporal averaging is not as, it does seem to be somewhat lost relative to wild type, which does fit with the fact that it's much more irregular. And the growth directions tend to also be more, normally the growth directions orient quite upward, and the growth directions orient more outward in that mutant too. So it's lost a little bit of its anisotropy, and it's definitely lost some of its spatial temporal averaging, yeah, which is cool. Okay, thank you very much.